The title of this talk was not really fistula and prolapse. The title of today is about new developments and best practices as we transform our narrative on maternal morbidities. And this is an excellent time to do so because we are at the end of the Millennium Development Goals, where a certain narrative was created, very effective. And now all of the MDGs are being reconsidered and being transformed into sustainable development goals that will guide us for the next decade and a half, I think. So it's a great time to think about how we're doing what we're doing with regard to maternal morbidities in general. And I think there's no better illustration of that whole dynamic than to talk about obstructed labor and obstetric fistula. So when we talk about funding morbidity care, any kind of morbidity care, in low and middle income nations, we're talking about something that's a little bit less finite than mortality care. Mortality is easier to measure. It's binary. You either survive or don't survive. There's a finiteness to it. But when it comes to morbidities care, you're not sure where to draw the line. And so we need to create a framework. And perhaps that framework could start with a platform of equity. And the primary output could be one of sustainable transformation, which basically means that you have instigated change and capacity to the degree that external funding can be substantively withdrawn, and you leave behind an intrinsically effective system that feeds and cares for itself in large part. How are we going to get there? Because equity is a big ticket, is it not? And when it comes to maternal morbidities, the equity we're talking about is between poor and wealthy nations. The degree to which women in poor countries suffer maternal morbidity and mortality is obscenely large compared to the degree to which that occurs for women in high-income nations. And you can just ask any pregnant woman in a high-income nation how she feels about being pregnant. And uniformly, she's quite happy about it, usually. Whereas if you ask a woman in a low or middle-income country how she feels about being pregnant, she will probably be happy, but she will also be very fearful. And making that fear go away is arguably one of the hallmarks of equity when it comes to maternal morbidity. So that interface, if we're going to get there from the concept of equity to sustainable transformation, has to invest in efficiencies of all resources, personnel, money, time, skill, training. It has to come from all sectors, industry, academic, social funders, international funders. Obstetric fistula highlights this phenomenon very well. So when babies are stuck in the pelvis, because it's just not a good fit, all sorts of soft tissue damage can occur, and many, 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 many things can occur. And for instance, in the beginning of the UNFPA video, yes, she had a fistula, which is a horrible, terrible thing. But what did she say? She said, I had the baby was dead, and then I realized I could not walk. Foot drop is a devastating consequence of obstructed labor. And if you're a remote living woman whose job involves carrying heavy things and farming in a remote area where there are no roads, there's no public transport, there's no such thing as a sidewalk, and your life is your body, and now you can't walk, that also is a significant problem. Of all of the morbidities that women have suffered as a result of surviving obstructed labor. So if they survive it, they often are damaged permanently. Obstetric fistula has taken the lead in highlighting the sequelae of this condition, though many other things can occur. Infertility, chronic pelvic pain, severe soft tissue fibrosis that prevent the woman from living a normal reproductive life, incontinence without fistula that can be quite severe, foot drop, separation of the pelvic bones that make it difficult to walk and create a lot of pain. Fistula has gotten a lot of attention, and deservedly so. It is a horrible condition. These women live lives that are worse than lepers. But there are many other morbidities as well. And so that's one of the things we need to think about when we think about efficacy and efficiency. We also have to backtrack. If we want to eradicate fistula, and we can, we did it in high-income countries at the turn of the 20th century. We had fistula everywhere in the world until the turn of the 20th century. In fact, the world's first fistula hospital was on the site of today's Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York on 51st and Park, and it was torn down because it was no longer necessary due to, I think, the advent of early forms of general anesthesia. Before the early 1900s, there was no anesthesia, but with the advent of chloroform and ether, it transformed surgery of all sorts, including making cesarean sections much more user-friendly. Now, so we still have obstructed labor everywhere in the world. We have it here today in Washington, D.C., but we pick it up in its earliest form, and we actively manage it. And very often, but not always, these women end up with cesarean section. In fact, early obstructed labor is the number one reason for doing a cesarean section in women who are pregnant for the first time, by a huge margin. And we know that in countries where fistula is occurring, in many of them, the population-based cesarean delivery rate is at or under 5%. Now, the optimal rate at which mortality is minimized is allegedly around 15%, according to certain epidemiologic studies. So we're looking at doubling, tripling, quadrupling of the cesarean section rate in countries where we want to eradicate end-stage obstructed labor to prevent obstetric fistula. To eradicate obstetric fistula, which is possible, it's been proven, it's happened in the course of human history in certain regions of the world. The fact that it persists today is not only unfair, it's a little bit enraging. So we can eradicate end-stage obstructed labor, and the way you do that is through cesarean section. But in the regions where obstructed labor continues to go to end-stage, causing death or disability, including fistula, we have fairly low cesarean section rates, and we know that those cesarean section rates will have to increase many-fold in order to get to some reasonable standard of care. How many midwives do we have here? Okay, there we go. These two are shaking their heads like this the whole time. So we know that, and here's the challenge. So to reduce obstetric fistula, we must increase cesarean section rates, and yet, even with these low cesarean section rates in obstetric fistula zones, we are seeing a growing proportion of women coming in with iatrogenic fistula. How many people know what iatrogenic means? It means that it's bad care caused the fistula, and it's surgical. And we have this reported in 15% of the caseload of fistula that we are dealing with and helping manage in the Fistula Care Plus project. We also have a very respected, excellent fistula surgeon who recently published his 18 years worth of data. 13.2% were iatrogenic fistula caused by surgery done poorly. Most of it from cesarean. A nice margin of it from fundal pressure, my midwifery colleagues. Thank you. And so we see real challenges. You can instantly see this very threatening dynamic occurring. As we increase cesarean sections for obstructed labor, are we just going to transform a big portion of them into iatrogenic fistula? What have we gained? They are much more complicated and much more likely to damage the kidney, iatrogenic fistula compared to obstetric. And it's not just a skills issue, although we have to look at that. Medical students are turned out into the community with no surgical training to do every surgery, including cesarean, and they're not doing a good job. Midwives don't often get adequate training, or even if they do, when they go out, they're working under absurd conditions that no one could do a good job in, and they use a lot of fundal pressure because they have to get those babies delivered. They got two on the bed, one on the floor. And we have to look at other issues as well, the conditions under which these clinicians are working. We have midwives who would be better off in Rwanda. I worked with midwives who said, I would rather be a driveway guard. I would make three times what I make as a midwife. They're working two and three jobs. They're exhausted all the time. Then they go to work, and they've got 20 patients per midwife. Who can do a good job under that condition? We have to start looking at things like patient-to-midwife ratio. I know of a hospital in West Africa that just feeds the fistula center down the hill because they're doing 15,000 deliveries. They went from 5,000 deliveries a year to 15 when they improved funding for maternity care, which is a great thing, right? But they forgot to build some more operating theaters, so they still have one operating theater for 15,000 patients. It's an obstetric fistula factory. They labor for 4 or 5 days because they're the last ones to get into the theater. They're not bleeding, they're not having seizures, they don't have a fever, so they're the last ones to get their cesarean section, or not, and then they roll them down the hill to the fistula center. We have to start looking at these conditions in addition to how people are getting their skills and whether or not these skills are adequate, in addition to infrastructure, electricity, water, waste management, supplies, thank you, Conrad. Supplies, supplies, supplies. We have to have adequate and affordable supplies coming into these countries. We can't be doing donations forever. The equation for fistula eradication is very simple. As Aaron Anastasi alluded to earlier, you prevent new cases, and then you efficiently identify and effectively treat the established cases. Fairly straightforward, yes? If we are going to mobilize resources to identify cases or prevent, in order to prevent new cases, we have to know what's causing the fistula in any given community. And while some of them are currently being funded, we fund obstructed labor fistula, we are now funding iatrogenic fistula by default. We've also accepted that sexual trauma can be a source of fistula, and we repair those as well. Some fistula are not amenable to surgery, and some fistula get missed, just either because they don't come in or they're coming from some other cause. But wouldn't it be wise, if we really want to harmonize our efforts with the healthcare systems in these countries, why not give them the information that they need to do the job they ultimately need to do for their community and tell them about all of the things we're seeing when we do a fistula screening camp, even if we don't put them on the table and do surgery? I think that this is a helpful thing to do that's cross-cutting and ultimately wise. Identifying fistula patients is an ongoing challenge, as was brought up with my colleagues at the panel. It's very stigmatizing, extremely. That's not the only hurdle, but it's one of the biggest. And if we know that most of these fistula, so far, are coming from obstructed labor, and we know that obstructed labor causes many other very severe quality of life, high impact conditions that also ruin the woman's life, why not think about proposing and funding and creating obstructed labor screening programs? I call fistula screening programs the truffle hunt. We're out there looking for the truffles. They're hard to find, and then they're hiding, and then it's a big challenge to find them. We mobilize healthcare community workers, and we do community outreach, and we do public service announcement, all about fistula, fistula, fistula. Wouldn't it be simpler if we said, we have a program for all women who have been in labor for more than 2 days? If you've been in labor for more than 2 days, or you know someone who's been in labor, please, we know they're suffering, bring them in. And then we can begin to utilize our resources possibly much more effectively. Again, if you can't walk from bilateral foot drop, it's great to have your fistula fixed. But there are also treatments for foot drop. She's in that hospital for 2 weeks post-op, and nobody's paying attention to the fact that she can't walk much of the time. Treatment. We're witnessing a transformation in the way fistula treatment is funded that also cross-cuts and helps us deal with other maternal morbidities as well. We're moving toward an integrated service delivery that engages economies of scale and scope, and we've spoken about that. I'll elaborate on that a bit further. And in terms of monitoring the programs that have been put in place, obviously we always want to make sure that externally funded programs are safe and effective. That's our job. So we call that monitoring and evaluation. But what we have now is a dynamic. We've been in country long enough that we can begin, I think, to interface with the monitoring systems at the clinical level in country, below the aggregate level, and start to mentor and review and assist in the development of quality assurance-based clinical monitoring through simple things like registries that would match symptoms to diagnoses and treatments to outcomes, and we begin to model quality assurance in a very real-life way, possibly. And why couldn't we, when we're thinking about finding fistula, when we're thinking about finding fistula and we're imagining that we could do obstructed labor screening programs, why not take something like this brand new curriculum from the East Central Southern African healthcare community that task shifts fistula care using catheters, thank you, toward nurses and midwives, and take this amazing curriculum, which you can find online. I encourage you all to go look at it. It's a remarkable body of work. Take this, expand it just a bit, and turn it into an obstructed labor screening program. Not only might that not be wiser, I think it's a fabulous new acronym. OLSP, yes, a fabulous new acronym. I think it will help us more efficiently identify fistula patients, arguably, but definitely it will help better serve the needs of women who have survived obstructed labor by addressing or at least identifying all of the true needs that they actually have. There are also cross-cutting risk factors and impacts of various maternal morbidities so that we can begin to harmonize and invest in economies of scale and scope. For instance, we know that long labor, especially ridiculously unhealthily long labor, is a risk factor for obstetric fistula. We know that. It's also a risk factor, at least in this latest data coming out of Ethiopia, in low and middle income nations, for higher degrees and higher rates of pelvic organ prolapse. If anybody doesn't know what that means, I don't have time to explain it. Now, I'll happily explain it at the break, or you can get on the internet and look it up. Also having many children. We think of fistula patients only as being the young child bride who's having a baby at 14. And while that is part of the demographic, and a very tragic part of the demographic, actually, if you go to a fistula camp, any fistula camp, at least half, if not more than half, will be mature mothers of many children, full-grown women. They've had 5, 6, 10, 12 babies. I've taken care of a patient who had a fistula with her 21st delivery. The first 20 she had at home. She was a camel herder in Somaliland. She had all her babies, on the road. No problem. The 21st baby was transversal eye obstructed labor. Okay, so we have that. And there's the data showing that in recent Ethiopia survey of women with pelvic organ prolapse, 75% had 5 or more childbirth histories. We also see cross-cutting impacts on quality of life. There's a recent study out of an outpatient clinic from one of our most renowned fistula surgeons, Dr. Mulu Muleta. In her clinic, there's about a 10 to 1 prolapse to fistula ratio. So this is approximately 350 severe prolapse patients and 37 fistula patients. And they applied the Beck Depression Inventory, which is a well-established screening tool, quick, for various degrees of depression. And almost all, as you can imagine, of the fistula patients were severely depressed, but so were 2/3 of the severe prolapse patients. Again, impact on quality of life. We're seeing all these ways that we can come together as they request from Ethiopia for a holistic approach to women with severe pelvic floor disorders, and that includes fistula, it includes prolapse, it includes incontinence, it includes congenital anomalies, et cetera, et cetera. And not all of these therapies are surgical, I'm sorry to say, as a surgeon. But so we have ways that we can invest in midwifery training to address some of these issues as well. And if we believe in it or not in the international reproductive health community, it's happening from a grassroots level. This, I'm sorry for that, but it was so enthusiastically handed to me. I said, I promise you, I'm going to show this every time I can. This is a brochure that my fistula surgeon colleague, Dr. Seba Akhtar, handed to me at the South Asian OBGYN meeting just a couple of months ago. She's so proud. She, on her own, pulled fistula into a broader spectrum of care. And I'm sorry, somebody told me this slide wasn't going to work, and they were right. It's in there with prolapse and various forms of incontinence and congenital anomalies and other injuries as well. So fistula is being pulled into a broader spectrum of care, which makes sense. It's also happening at a remarkable level in Ghana. The senior fistula surgeons, who are well known to all of us in the fistula community of practice, took it upon themselves a few years ago to launch Africa's first fully academically accredited urogynecology fellowship. Urogynecology in the United States is prolapse, incontinence, and some other stuff on the side, chronic pelvic pain. In Africa, it's fistula prolapse and incontinence. So now they have this fully accredited full-on academic program for fellows, and they have engaged International Urogynecologic Association for academic backstop and in-country training. And we have here with us today Chuck Shields. Chuck, raise your hand. Who is the executive director of International Urogyne Association, if anyone has any questions later. But you see these amazing intrinsic programs happening already. Let's be a part of it. Let's be a part of it. Because it's happening, let's make sure that the training that's happening there is to the same standard to the fistula training that we've been working so hard to keep up to the best possible standard, and also to advocate and always be present and hypervigilant that the fistula patients in these integrated programs somehow don't drop down in the priority list. They stay up at the top of the priority list. We have to engage. We have to be present. These things are ongoing. Let's be a part of it. And we have that. And Fistula Care Plus, it had a preceding project called Fistula Care, which was solely devoted to identifying, treating, and reintegrating women with fistula. That's it. But with Fistula Care Plus, which started in 2013, per our USAID mandate, we have an arm to look at prevention of fistula. And I think for us, for our small group, the maternal health community needs to work with partograms and conditions of working on eradicating end-stage obstructive labor. But for us, it's about iatrogenic fistula. Big, 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 very scary dynamic going on for the prevention side. And then also to integrate prolapse into our systems, not because someone thought it was a good idea, because the women come to the clinics and it's horrifying to turn them away. They're really suffering, and for the, particularly for those who don't have the money, and some prolapse patients are very wealthy, by the way, but for those who don't in poor countries, it can be on a scale of in the equal neighborhood of quality of life impact as fistula. We also see our colleagues at UNFPA who have been very active with prolapse in Nepal for some years now, bringing it into sub-Saharan Africa through their active programs, recent programs, just a couple of months ago, I think, right, Aaron? In Ethiopia. And so we can also begin to consider, there may be some settings where silo model care delivery is simply smarter, but probably integrated multiple service delivery is going to be smarter. But so we can begin to discuss that at the level as international participants in this process. There may be, again, we're familiar with silo model funding and service delivery, and it might work better in certain circumstances. Let's figure out what those criteria are, but understand that an integrated model is happening from the grassroots up, whether we do it or not, it's going to happen. But we have to also look at the Millennium Development Goal menu of beliefs, I call it, regarding, again, through the lens of preventing obstetric fistula. There is a narrative that was developed, and it's held forth by every stakeholder organization represented in this room today, that these are social determinants that we hold very near and dear, that we state are mandatory to eradicate fistula, and let's just take a quick look so we can go have some wine and look at blankets. Forced marriage, young child, young marriage, and young childbirth, that somehow we need to push first baby post 18 years of age and make sure she's educated in the process and empower her in many, many different ways. Also empower women at large through family planning, always a good idea. It reduces all obstetric risk issues because it minimizes the number of times you're pregnant in a lifetime. And antenatal care, not intrapartum care, antenatal care is mandatory to eradicate fistula. Emancipation is mandatory to eradicate fistula. And oh, by the way, let's get rid of gender-based violence and things that are scary, like female genital circumcision, mandatory to eradicate fistula. This is what you will read in the mission statements of many organizations. And then finally, emergency obstetric and neonatal care. Now that's the core of it, really. That's the real core. We know that we have eradicated fistula, obstetric fistula, in high-income countries. It happened at the turn of the 20th century. It happened on or around 1900, 1920 something. How do we know this? Well, the Fistula Hospital was opened in 1878, I think, and it was closed in around 1928, and it was torn down because it was no longer necessary. So right in that period, fistula was eradicated in high-income countries. And let's think about all of these allegedly mandatory determinants that we hold true today and see what was going on historically at that time for women at the time that fistula was eradicated. Now, this is a pre-antibiotic era. Few people had phones, few people had electricity, few people had cars. There was no such thing as an airplane. There was no UNICEF. There was some public health, but there was certainly no childhood nutrition program. So we weren't thinking about making sure that pelvis were big enough for babies to just fall out with no problem and getting girls to bone age maturity between 15 and 17 before they have a baby. Life expectancy was well under 50. Illiteracy and minimal literacy was common. Child labor was normal. We are living in the vestiges of it. Why do we have summer vacation? Because kids had to work on the farm. They couldn't go to school. That's why we have summer vacation, not to feed the tourist industry. Marriage occurred shortly after menarche, and of course you immediately began having babies, and you had as many babies as you could because the only birth control was lactation and avoiding your husband. And there was no such thing as antenatal care. There was no notion of gender-based violence as a human rights issue for women, and women further didn't have rights to much of anything at all, including the right to vote or hold office. And yet, in that environment, I'm just putting it out there, fistula was eradicated. Why? I really don't know. I'm not a medical anthropologist, but if I had to guess, It was probably the fact that it was the advent around that time, general anesthesia in its very earliest forms was developed. We're talking chloroform and ether on a cloth. And it revolutionized all of surgery. Before that, someone held you down and someone else did whatever cutting you needed done. And not a lot of cesareans were done under those circumstances. But afterwards, it revolutionized everything, including obstetric operative delivery. And possibly that was a catalyst at that time in those cultures. We need to figure out what today's catalyst is. And I truly believe that the key is build it and they will come. Let's have competently trained people who are working under competent conditions. And people will come. Communities will engage. They will. That's the key. That's where we have to focus our efforts. It's nice to cross message with things like everybody marry after 18, but don't forget, we've eradicated fistula here for generations now, and every year in the United States, about 12,000 girls under the age of 15, give birth to babies. You're never going to eradicate babies having babies, and it's not a, never a good thing. Nobody likes it, but it's not mandatory to eradicate fistula. Okay, I said it. So to summarize these cross-cutting narratives, prevention is about eradicating obstructed labor. In terms of screening, let's think about obstructed labor screening programs, possibly. Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. We have to be hyper-vigilant about this dynamic between reducing obstetric fistula to make sure we don't transform these women into iatrogenic fistula. It's already occurring, and it's really a bit of a nightmare. And then the academic transformations are magical. That's the real sustainability. We can't do the academic transformations. Those are intrinsic to the societies, but we can certainly show up and support, and we can advocate, and we can use our bully pulpits. And again, do we want girls who just have a big pelvis, who get to the age of 18 and they're married? I mean, that's like saying our goal is that she should happily be able to have a baby under a tree. This is not the goal. The goal is that every woman, every time, has access to a facility that is outfitted and staffed to meet a minimum standard of care, within which both the health outcomes of the baby and the mother are optimized, and that care is rendered in a humane, kind, and caring fashion. Thank you.